Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Psych2Go presents The Psychology of People, The Little Book of Psychology and What Makes You, You, by Thomas Kang, narrated by Tim Lunabus. Publisher's note: the information provided in this book is based on the research, insights, and experiences of the author. Every effort has been made to provide accurate and up-to-date information. However, neither the author nor the publisher warrants the information provided is free of factual error. This book is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any medical condition or disease, nor is it intended as a substitute for professional medical care. All matters regarding your health should be supervised by a qualified healthcare professional. The author and publisher disclaim all liability for any adverse effects arising out of or relating to the use or application of the information or advice provided in this book. Introduction stuff. About us. Oh, apologies for the abrupt intro. We'd like to tell you more about who we are and what we do. And I mean, we'd really like to let you know. Because it's overwhelmingly common for people to get the most engaged when they talk about themselves. There's your first cool psych fact of the book. Yay! We promise they get way cooler than that. But anyways, who we are is simple. We're Psych2Go, a mental health informer aiming to spread interest and awareness in various topics within the psychology and wellness sphere using academic studies, expert opinions, and of course, our little buddy, mascot, Psy. We believe in research-backed, practical advice and knowledge that serves to educate and comfort. With a following of more than 10 million subscribers on YouTube and over 800,000 combined followers on other social media, such as Instagram and Facebook, as well as a magazine, online blog, and interviewing presence, Psych2Go has firmly established itself as one of the frontrunners in the business of making the machinations of the mind a marvel for the masses. Ahem. If we do say so ourselves. I mean, that's cool and all, I guess. Mental health, education, 10 million subscribers. But what does it all exactly mean? These days, mental health informer is as broad a term as operational assistant or big fan. There's no indicator of the breadth, depth, or motivation behind the phrase. In the day and age of people constantly trying to one-up each other on their moral superiority, the proclamation that one is or should be a mental health advocate seems almost like a platitude. But believe us, we realize how grave this work is. We realize how devastating it is to be unwell and how all-consuming the void can be. That's not to make the presumptuous claim that we viscerally know exactly how heavy your burden is, or anyone else's for that matter. We're saying we know that in any case, it's present, it's real, and it hurts. Sometimes it hurts just you. Sometimes it hurts your family. Sometimes it hurts your partner. Sometimes it hurts everyone and anyone around you. So why make a YouTube channel? Why run an internet presence at all? Why write a book? Simple. We have a mission, and that mission is to spread our message everywhere we can, especially in places where the ones who believe in it are most restricted. By being as present in as many places as possible, we can let people know that not only are they being heard by us, but we also want them to know it will be okay. And the more media through which we can achieve that, the better. Some fantastic stories, studies, and experiences out there will resonate better through chapters in a book than frames in a video. We'll get you to master your mind and become aware of what's going on in others. And we'll start by doing it with science. What science? You know, the discoveries and observations that we've made throughout history. We'll be discussing mostly the ones written down in a lab environment, as those are the most reliable and distilled descriptions, and the science-y people we'll talk about tended to focus mostly on practical inquiry, i.e., stuff that you, lovely listener, would actually care about. We'd hope, though, that you're already interested in all of this. After all, it's safe to say that most people can agree that psychology is awesome. Seriously, who hasn't dreamed of gaining Professor X-like powers and taking over the world by reading the minds of all of your adversaries to gain a leg up on them. Just us? Is Professor X a dated reference now? He's the bald guy who reads minds. We'd estimate that this kind of superpower fantasy is at least like 65% relevant to psychology. After all, isn't psychology like a bunch of scientists trying to see what's going on in people's minds? Honestly, not that far off. Unlike in comic books, we in the real world can't just noom our way into other people's brains. What we do have, though, are estimations of how they kind of operate. You'll learn more about this later, but researchers have likened the facilities of the brain to how a computer works, a computer that we can analyze structurally, i.e., looking at the parts of the brain that you can theoretically touch and what they do, and behaviorally, i.e., what output do we get from a given input. The inferences we make from these analyses give us hints about what underlies thoughts, feelings, and motivations. If we want insights into why or how people react or feel about certain things, we run experiments. Lucky for us, experiments are conducted under a specific set of conditions that make it such that, for people like us, once the results are in, you have a decent understanding of the phenomenon it was looking at. Take that explanation with a grain of salt. A lot of other stuff muddies the water when it comes to these investigations. You know, stuff like the peer review process and the politics of publishing and the selection bias of studies that get approved for funding in the first place and the inherently biased nature of certain analyses and the importance of context and confounding factors and, well, we'll keep it simple. Our presentation will already have these things factored in, so all you need to know is that this is generally what happens. The body of cumulative knowledge gained through these studies is what we call science, or more specifically, when referring to science that talks about human thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, psychology. Why listen about psychology? If there's anything that will enhance the listening experience of this book, it's learning why you're listening to it, and that is what this section aims to assist with. If you're willing to graciously lend your time to listen to the next little bit in this section, it'll surely be worth it. Now, this isn't to say that choosing a book as a leisurely activity always has to be such a serious undertaking. Like, can't my reason be that I'm bored? Just that books are usually better enjoyed with a little sprinkle of context is all. Of course, if you've already made up your mind about the book, whatever your motivation, then good on you. It's important to note, though, that to a degree, everyone's reason will be multifaceted. Even if you find yourself already set on this book, this introduction aims to introduce you to further virtues of a more sophisticated knowledge of psychology. We're trying to cover most of our bases here. Some might be seeking a nice, light book that they can turn to at any time to chew on the trivia or ideas presented within. Others may find themselves drawn to this book for the potential to extract benign social manipulation tactics, or, as we call them nowadays, psychological life hacks. Rest assured, you'll find your trivia and life hacks within the juicy chapters of this book. But you want to know what this book is really all about? The whole reason it was written in the first place? Well, it's about you. Yes, you. Did you become viscerally aware of your position in space just now? Does it suddenly feel like your vision has expanded? Maybe you feel a little itch on your body that you didn't realize you were ignoring. Or maybe you realized your posture is out of whack. That's okay, because, full disclosure, we were totally trying to spook you just now. To get back to the matter at hand, we at Psych2Go know that to master psychology is to master oneself. To make an analogy, we'll say living life as you, the human, is like driving a car. Generally, as time goes on, most people become decently functional drivers, except that guy that cut me off yesterday. That was seriously rude. You generally don't have to know the exact mechanisms of a car to pilot it. You learn and get better by driving more and accumulating experience. However, if you encounter a problem with your car or get curious as to how it works, well, you won't know what everything under the hood does just by taking a cursory glance at it. no matter how many miles you have logged. Yes, the lived experience is vital, but so is obtaining the knowledge necessary to know what you're working with. This is why car manuals, mechanic apprenticeships, and online tutorials exist, because there are some things that you can't know intuitively, or would at least be way too time-consuming or inefficient to find out yourself. Allow this book to be the manual for the human brain, specifically, your human brain. What exactly is in it for us to talk about you, though? That is, talking about you, to you. Well, we believe that such knowledge could very well be one of the greatest tools we have in the fight against the mental health crisis, which, at the time of writing, affects more than 50% of the world's population. Stoicism is a philosophical practice that attempts to ground itself emotionally by viewing the world as a set of facts and systems. If we can understand why we feel or think the things we do, maybe we can understand how to deal with those feelings and thoughts. To attain insight into the workings of the brain, despite its elusive nature, is to gain valuable perspective on life itself, the perspective of the objective world free from speculatory bias. By no means is this a comprehensive summary of such a storied school of thought, but any more would be delving into territory beyond this book's purview. Steel your sensibilities so that life shall hurt you as little as possible. Zeno of Sicium. Of course, dissemination of clinical psychology facts isn't the only measure being taken for mental health advocacy. Far from it. And just as well, it's possible that you aren't that concerned about this whole ordeal. Maybe you picked up this book because you want to sit down with some quirky trivia. That's completely valid. Don't get us wrong. By putting this out there, we can at least say we've achieved one more instance of raising awareness for the issue. In any case, we won't bog you down with any more of that deep Socrates-type know-thyself mumbo. Whether or not you do care about all that stuff, it'd be nice if you did, though. We hope you enjoy the book for some reason or another. It'll be useful for something, that's for sure. For example, did you feel more compelled to keep listening after we started this section with the sentence, "Apologies for the abrupt intro"? If you felt just a little more convinced, you've experienced a psychology trick firsthand. There's more on that specific trick in its own dedicated section later, so keep listening. Or just skip to that section. We honestly don't mind, really. The whole book is formatted so that you can skip to any section and it'll still be fun. Chapter 1. Do you see what I see? Neuropsychology and perception. Back in ye old days, our understanding of everything was kind of more nebulous. Illnesses were caused by bad vibes and miasma. Rain was water that spawned from space. There was less scientific method to it all, and more intuiting about how things worked. That isn't to say these theories or models of the world were primitive. They laid the groundwork for the more empirical knowledge structures that we have today. Well then, with that knowledge in mind, it won't be too much of a shocker that at one point we didn't have a framework within which we could think about how the human mind operates. To this day, the mind is this wishy-washy, abstract concept to most. Loads of people don't think of it as something that can even be analyzed using hard science. Providing context on how the smart science-type people have attempted to turn it into a true blue scientific discipline will aid greatly in understanding what's coming up in this book. Though this knowledge is not necessary, it'll enhance your enjoyment and comprehension of the book, I think. You probably have interacted with a computer at least once in your life, right? Like in any capacity, the computer in your phone, do you have a phone? The computer in your car's GPS, do you have a car? The computer in your robot dog's cranial casing, huh? Most people know their way around some sort of computational device. Let's take the basic example of a calculator. You put in numbers, tell it what operation you want performed, and get new numbers. That's crazy. As we mentioned in the intro, this is how neuroscientists model the way our brain works, as computers. That is, input moves to storage processing, which moves to output. This might seem a little rudimentary, but it's taken a long time to reach that conclusion. Since we all live in the same world, that would mean that the input for most people experiencing the same event would be the same. That also means that after processing, the output would yield the same thing, right? But that would mean a world where everyone reacts the same way as their friend or neighbor. And we know that that is definitely not the case. So what gives? First, the brain is way more complex than the simple model we've got here. You can truncate the process down to a few words, but we're taking each step for granted if we look at things superficially. Let's begin with the input part. Even when two people look at the same thing, they may not perceive it the same way. For instance, if you and Sai come from different cultures and observe a party full of people, you may recognize your friends, enjoy hearing your favorite song played on the speakers, and feel excited hearing people cheer in your native language. In contrast, Sai may see a group of unfamiliar faces, feel anxious about the DJ's turntable plugged into a loose outlet, that's a fire hazard, and find everyone speaking in a foreign language they don't understand. You might take in the great sense of the sweet perfume of guests trying to impress each other, whereas Sai could be less sensitive to the smell of perfume and instead notice the odor of sweaty dancers on the dance floor. Although you are receiving the same visual, auditory, and olfactory inputs, you may be taking in a grand old time while Sai is taking in an anxiety attack waiting to happen. And second, we're also skipping over the processing part a bit too haphazardly. Many forces are at play regarding how we react to things, even if we don't realize we're reacting at all. Our instinctual responses to past and present input can inform how we store and process future input. Someone compliments your clothes. You store it in your short-term memory so you don't immediately forget what they said. You have an internal reaction to the compliment, consisting of becoming a little bit happier, and an external reaction, consisting of a smile and a thank you. Now imagine this keeps happening. People often compliment your clothes whenever you show up to school, or work, or the old-timey confectionery shop, etc. Over many years, you have many fond memories of people complimenting you. From this, you gain lots of pride in your fashion sense. You carry yourself confidently whenever you wear a new outfit and are happy when thinking about clothes. It's like you've been programmed to have a positive affinity for fashion and your appearance. This is evident in that we can feasibly imagine that someone could dress the same way as you, but feel terrible about their appearance if they've only received negative feedback about their outfits. You'll often find that when we experience something, we don't understand it by itself. We understand it in the context of what we know about everything around it. For example, people tasting a new food for the first time will often say something like, "It tastes like this other food, except sweeter." They're putting the perception of the flavor in the context of previous experiences. So if people are always contextualizing their situations, why do people sometimes act irrationally or feel things they shouldn't? Can't we ask people why they do the things they do, and they'll tell us the root cause? After all, they're the ones mapping out the context for themselves. Well, what if the answer is, they don't know? Psychologists in the early 1900s and many philosophical movements such as Buddhism converged on the idea that you don't actively have to think of something for it to affect you. We take the idea for granted nowadays, but early psychologists such as William James, Pierre Janet, and Sigmund Freud were some of the first and most famous ones to posit a system of thought influenced by things that weren't memories or knowledge being actively recalled. You don't always know why you dream about the things you do, but they couldn't have come from nowhere, right? This was the beginning of realizing we are heavily influenced by our subconscious. They got a lot of things wrong, of course, but those things could be ironed out later. The fact is, they got this banger of an idea correct. Things that get lodged into our minds have a tight grip on how we think and react to things, whether we know it or not. Our brains sometimes control us, and not the other way around. To bring this back to the computer analogy, we are unaware of what is inputted. And we're certainly unaware of how the storage and processing are corrupted, twisted, manipulated, and reinterpreted based on what went in and what's already there. We don't think a thought because we decide on it. It's more like thoughts happen at us. You don't see a jump scare in a scary movie and think, "Ah, yes, quite scary. I've analyzed this situation, and this checks all the boxes for what I consider scary. I should express this somehow." And then make the conscious decision to scream and maybe pee a little. Your body decides to react first based on the framework it has in place to deal with the category of scary things. Notably, this happens before you can even think about it. You can consciously try to brace yourself for a scary situation and make a concerted effort not to scream or pee, but you can see the voluntary part of the response is in the restraint of output and not the production of it. The long and short of it is, our brains are gigantic, entangled spaghetti nests of frameworks intertwined with other frameworks built upon millions of years of evolution and cultural influences. An unbelievable amount of trial and error has brought us to the point that our thought and perception processes are highly efficient, but only efficient enough to ensure our propagation as a species. You might think that your mind is working as well as it possibly can, that the world and how you think about it is how it appears. The fact of the matter is, however, that there's so much happening in the dark, unbeknownst to the most perceptive and objective individuals. In the end, there is a high degree to which we're subordinate to our programming. But are we to acquiesce to this fate? Or can we rise above our proverbial ones and zeros to achieve an understanding of the world in a more holistic sense? Well, maybe we can start by learning the ins and outs of the pathways our inputs and processes take before becoming outputs. Seeing the world in low resolution. Is a pile of several mashed potatoes just one gigantic mashed potato? Do you know what a thumbnail is? In the internet business, it's the little picture that represents the thing you're about to click. You know when you look up a video and next to the title is an image of the video, kind of like a book cover? That image is called a thumbnail. It's not nearly as big as the video in content or image quality, but you can generally make out what it is and what it's trying to say most of the time if it's a good thumbnail. You don't need the thumbnail to tell every detail of what will happen in the video because that's what the video is for. The thumbnail provides a good preview or summary of what you may be getting into if you click onward. Again, you can think of it kind of like a book cover. A cover won't have the entire text of the book written out on it. It's something to visually represent the book that you don't have to squint at to take in all the details. Introduction to heuristics. Our mind works by packaging everything into tiny thumbnails. We call these heuristics. I won't do this often with new words, but I'd like you to remember to recognize this word going forward in this section. A heuristic is a shortcut. A cognitive heuristic, like a mental shortcut, is an attempt to bypass the complicated, detailed thinking process and apply a quick fix to whatever input you've just been faced with. Let's take the example of stereotypes. Stereotypes are a common heuristic. The stereotypical clown, for example, has a set of traits associated with them automatically by their membership in the category of clown. You'd probably think they're generally goofy, funny, skilled at making balloon animals, and nice to children. We use a heuristic, a shortcut, to assume some things about most clowns we meet, so we don't have to interview them about their every trait and feel like we have to get to know them deeply and intimately to conclude who they are. Imagine sitting down for a chat with a clown, and the first thing you ask is, "Are you funny?" The idea of doing this seems silly, because being funny is assumed from the outset. The world would be a horrifying place to live if we didn't use heuristics. You probably don't realize when you're using them. We simplify everything, literally everything, that we see all the time. When you look at a person, you don't count every pore on their face, the exact stitching of the fabric of their clothes, and whether their socks are pulled up to symmetric heights. When you're in a room, you may not notice the presence of one or two items within it if they're not immediately in need of attention. This could include entire people. Speaking of not noticing other humans, think about when you see a crowd. You don't see individual faces. you see a blob of people. It's not that you're willfully ignoring them. It's more like the default state is ignorance and you have to make an effort to pay attention. You might be thinking, wow, so much information is lost due to our use of heuristics. I have to learn to break free of using shortcuts and always be hyper-aware of my surroundings. But this is not exactly entirely, 100%, completely, undeniably true. Heuristics are so prevalent because they're really effective. 90 times out of 100, they work just fine and present you with a serviceable picture of the world. The thumbnail isn't in 4K cinema quality, sure, but it's still legible enough for you to comfortably recognize the important bits. If your mind kept tabs of every single detail of every single thing around you at all times, you'd go insane in no time flat. A practical application of heuristics that you've seen before but probably weren't aware of is in the Gestalt principles of perception. I'm not going to lie. When I first heard about this, I thought Gestalt was the name of the person who made up this idea. But it's not a person. It's the German word approximating what we know in English as shape or configuration. The idea was developed by Max Wertheimer, Kurt Kafka, and Wolfgang Kohler way back when, early 1900s-ish. So it should be called the Wertheimer-Kafka-Kohler Principles of Perception. Though this alternative name is largely impractical in common parlance, I like it because it is extremely intimidating and extremely German. The Gestalt Principles of Perception. The Gestalt Principles, or Gestaltism, dictate that people see things as a whole. Our minds fill in blanks. If there's 70% of a picture of a square present, we can assume what is in front of us is, for all intents and purposes, a square. But wait, didn't I say this has a practical application? Well, other than using this to freak out your friends with optical illusions, it doesn't look like it. However, Gestaltism informs an important and ubiquitous school of thought. Often people point to graphic design as a prime example of Gestaltism's practical use case, but you can also apply it more broadly to things like music. Individual notes don't carry too much meaning behind them, but being played at the same time as another note to make a chord can communicate a mood immediately. You can even see this being applied in conversation. Someone can mangle a sentence badly, but you can still come away with the meaning of their speech most of the time. Kind of like how this book is written, as a rambling stream of consciousness, but you're still vibing with it, right? Right? Relating this idea to heuristics, more specifically, Gestaltism shows us that we see things as an overall image before breaking them down into their constituent parts. Imagine Psy portrayed as a stereotypical, tough-as-nails miscreant. That's the immediate impression we get, and upon further analysis, we can point to details such as the skull necklace, the sunglasses, the angry expression, and the body language that contribute to the overall image of a tough cookie. Now consider this. Bam! By depicting Psy smiling and surrounded by cute animals, we are now forced to reevaluate their identity. We can now describe them as a ruffian with a soft spot for nature. But note the phraseology used here. We're still stereotyping Psy, but adding a stipulation. We still see Psy as a package deal of traits. As much as the knowledge of their animal friends has swayed our view of them, using the stereotype of a tough person as a baseline template. It is upon that template we fill in details that may either contribute to or detract from the pure essence of the stereotype, but in the end, if Psy shows us that they are 70% something, we mostly assume the unseen 30% won't need to be accounted for, as it's unlikely to change Psy's overall image so drastically that it becomes something else entirely. Storytellers use this all the time in media. There's a reason character tropes exist. You'll usually see similar characters across different movies or books or shows. The nerd, the boring schoolteacher, the caring parent, the goofball. This isn't because the people making these characters are unoriginal. Usage of stereotypical characters with some unique traits to make them memorable provides the audience with some immediate context of what to expect from them, so we aren't left completely in the dark. The intricacies of their motivations, backstory, and quirks can be left for the audience to figure out later. but having some sort of framework within which to see their actions helps us not be frantically and consistently trying and failing to evaluate every situation they're in to get a read on them.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?